How do you crazy mofos? It's time for another oneliner.com podcast. I, as always, am Craig Eastman, and in Glasgow, as per usual, is Scott Morris.
Delighted to meet you.
Lurking in the shadows of Falkirk, waiting to jump out and bite you on the arse with his opinion, is Drew Tavendale.
Hello.
Hey, sharp opinion, sore arse. Let's crack on. You may remember from 1992 the, well, fucking depressing film Bad Lieutenant, directed by Abel Ferrara and starring Harvey Keitel as a drug-addled police officer, corrupt to the bone, fond of masturbating against cars with young women in them, racking up huge gambling debts, and looking for some sort of Catholic salvation whilst investigating the rape of a nun. Werner Herzog has decided to tackle similar subject matter with his film Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans, set in the post-Katrina New Orleans. It stars Nicolas Cage as a corrupt police lieutenant, addicted to painkillers and increasingly other substances, and with gambling debts, but therein largely the similarities end. Scott, take us through Bad Lieutenant.
Well, it's very much a film of two halves, isn't it? The first half is a fairly pedestrian police procedural for the most part, with Cage sort of setting up his stall as the drug-addled bad lieutenant, getting increasingly more dependent on drugs after a back injury at the start of the film. A particularly poorly explained back injury as well. He just seems to fall into some water and then go, oh, I've got a bad back for some reason, and continue from there on in. And then it follows, I guess, a predictable enough trajectory as he gets more and more dependent on both drugs and his prostitute girlfriend, and he winds up getting involved in increasing gambling debts and roughing up some people that he perhaps should not rough up, all the while he's trying to investigate the drug-related deaths of a family of immigrants, which he suspects at the hands of one of the kind of local kingpin drug dealers. So he's trying to keep all of that together at the same time as keeping himself high. As I say, the first half of it is, first hour's more or less predictable enough, and it's not particularly bad as such, but it wasn't doing an awful lot for me. And then the second half goes batshit mental. I think it's almost exactly the 1 hour mark where there's this ground level tracking shot of an alligator that's witnessed the road accident. And by the time the singing iguanas throw up, it's clear that Werner's off his meds as much as Nick Cage's character is on them. I can't really come up with a metric for saying that it's a good film, so I'm not even going to pretend that it is, but I was completely enthralled by it towards the end just to see what would happen at the end. It's a powerhouse performance from Nick Cage. It's simultaneously absolutely terrible and the best thing I've ever seen. By the end of it, he's devouring square yards of film at a time as he's gone so totally off the rails. It's just a joy to watch. The plot becomes pretty much irrelevant by the end of it. It's all just sort of gravitating around Nick Cage's central performance like a big scary black hole. It kind of wraps itself into an unexpectedly neat ball at the end, which I actually wasn't expecting at all, and it doesn't sort of, I suppose it kind of makes sense in the context of the film because it's gone so crazy anyway that when an almost parodically crazy ending happens, it just kind of makes sense. By any conventional standard, it's a pretty poor film, but it's such an unconventional film that judging it on conventional scales seems entirely inadequate. I can only say that it's absolute garbage, but it's really, really brilliant garbage.
I really rather enjoyed it. To me, the best way I can think to describe it is as if David Lynch was tasked with making a police corruption drama, but he was given a huge dose of sedatives beforehand. So you just get these moments of complete insanity slipping through.
Yeah.
The stuff with the imagined iguanas, I'm like, okay, that's a bit odd.
What
that's
are these fucking iguanas doing on my coffee table? What?
But then, for the point at which it gets to shoot him again, his soul is still dancing. I just was completely in love with it. Like you say, there's no real metric for dealing with a film like this. It kind of follows a conventional narrative, but at the same time doesn't. I don't know what to make of it, Drew.
My thoughts would largely mirror both of yours. Although the plot is more or less irrelevant anyway, it's a character piece. And Scott's right, you couldn't say with any degree of sincerity that it's a good film. It is, however, hugely entertaining and quite refreshing too to see Nick Cage turn up in three films in a row, I think, now that he's been at the very least competent, starting with Knowing last year, where he decided to at least turn up on set, and then following that up with Kick-Ass and then this. It reminds you that given something good and a good director and apparently some interest, He's quite astonishingly entertaining, if clearly batshit crazy.
Yeah.
And it's not... I wouldn't watch it for the plot, but you could just sit and watch Nick Cage be entirely unhinged and terrorise grannies for a couple of hours quite happily any day of the week.
Depriving them of oxygen and then sticking a gun to their head.
Yes.
What a guy.
Yeah, nothing more to add. He's good. Watch.
I have to say that I'm not really familiar with Herzog's back catalogue. The only two other Herzog films I've seen were Grizzly Man and your one from a couple of years back with Christian Bale as the pilot shot down over Korea.
Rescue Dawn.
Yeah, that was it, Rescue Dawn. But on the strength of this, I'm going to have to check out stuff like Fitzcarraldo and Aguirre, Wrath of God. Yeah, there's stuff with Klaus Kinski, who is, again, noted as being a bit of a mentalist. If it's anything like this, then it's got to be worth a look in.
Just,
easy to love, but hard to qualify why.
Yeah, I would like to put one thing just you mentioned slightly at the start of your introduction, Craig, but just for anybody else confused or suspecting something different, as I was at first, that it bears no relation to the 1992 Abel Ferrara film other than it has the same name.
Which could only be a good thing. I remember not watching Bad Lieutenant back when we were of an age, I guess, sort of 15 or so, because it was one of those films that you watch at that age because it is controversial and all that. And
yes.
I think even then I realised that it was quite bad.
Yeah, well, I was speaking to Craig about this yesterday and mentioned that the only thing I can clearly remember from the first film at all, and unfortunately it's this bit that has stuck in my head and it's not the bit you were to choose, is Harvey Keitel masturbating against a car. It's the only thing I remember from the first film.
It's not a good calling card for a film, is it?
No, it's not.
The original Bad Lieutenant is a bold piece of filmmaking. It's a pretty good film, but it's not possible to enjoy it, I don't think. I know that probably sounds a bit daft, but it'd be a very difficult film to enjoy. It's a solid piece of filmmaking, and it was certainly, it certainly made a bold statement, but... likeable.
Yeah, but I just wanted to point out, it bears no relation to the original film at all, and even Herzog himself, expecting film buffs to be trying to compare the two films to see if there are any relation between them, simply said, go for it, losers. So you can see where he stands and whether there are any similarities to the two films other than name.
Well, Abel Ferrara, apparently, when he heard that this was being made, said, oh, I don't know why anyone's remaking it. Anyone involved in it should all burn in hell. No sitting on the fence there, Abel.
What an asshat.
Yes, exactly. And apparently also, I think reading from the trivia on IMDb, he's quoted as saying he can't understand why Nicolas Cage would play Harvey Keitel. Well, he's not.
No.
No.
I think he's confused about what films are. Someone's played it to him.
We'll add Abel Ferrara to our list of pricks for this week. There'll be another one popping up later on. Let's move on to Prince of Persia, The Sands of Time, based on the computer game series that dates back to, Christ, 1989 or something like
the
that.
The dawn of computers, I believe.
The dawn of computers. Jordan Mechner's classic platform adventure, and now being given the big screen treatment by the producers of Pirates of Caribbean. Scott, what's it all about?
Well, there's traditionally been a very handy shorthand for judging the quality of any film that's based on a video game. Essentially, if it exists, it's dreadful. to varying degrees of dreadful, you get things like Max Payne, which was only somewhat dreadful, to things that are about as dreadful as it's possible to actually be, things like Street Fighter and Super Mario Brothers. Prince of Persia kind of shatters this worldview by being not too bad, to be honest, and actually quite enjoyable, which is just all sorts of wrong.
Say it ain't so, Scott.
It is, more or less.
You're shattering my illusions.
You've gone Herzog mental.
I've gone off the rails, Cage style. It's based somewhat loosely on the Prince of Persia Sands of Time game from a few years back on the PS2. Jake Gyllenhaal steps into the curly sandals of Dastan, first taken into the royal family of Persia when he's discovered as a young, brave, acrobatic street urchin and raised for more or less arbitrary reasons as a brother to the two real princes of the nation. Things get a bit interesting a few years later when he's a more or less grown up, and the Persian nation is attacking a holy city under the suspicion of them supplying arms to their enemies. Dastan plays an integral and suitably acrobatic part in securing the city, run by Princess Tamina, played by Gemma Arterton, who is in pretty much every other film these days. But Dastan is almost immediately suspected of assassinating the king. The rest of the film follows him trying to clear his name, work out which of his family members as responsible for the crime, and also the secrets of this dagger that Tamina is desperate to protect. Players of the game or watchers of the trailer will know that this dagger allows the wielder to turn back time for limited amounts, allowing all sorts of zany action to occur. I'm not saying it's predictable who the bad guy turns out to be, but Ben Kingsley is in this film. Now, at least Mike Newell and the writing team take care to do something that almost never happens in video game translations, which is to actually look at what made the video game sort of interesting and enjoyable in the first case. In this case, it's the flippy floppy acrobatics, which translate and are suitably impressive here, and also the basic good nature of the central character and his witty dialogue and awkward but charming relationship slash love interest with Tamira take centre stage here and work just as well as he did in the game. It's just nice to play a character that wasn't a boastful, arrogant, bombastic Twazik in the game, and it's just as rewarding watching him here. Unfortunately, the one meh aspect of the game kind of carries over as well. In the game, the combat mechanics weren't an awful lot of fun, and that's kind of moved over into the fighting and the action scenes in here. It just feels a little bit like filler. None of it's bad exactly, but it's far from jaw-dropping, and the sort of CG used in lavish amounts is, again, not noticeably lacking, but it's not standing out from the crowd either. The acting, from all concerned, is well above average. Gyllenhaal and Arterton are likeable, and special mention must be made of Alfred Molina's superb supporting comic role. After all, it's difficult to hate a character that puts an ostrich on suicide watch. The plastering of the from the producers of the Pirates of the Caribbean for once is fairly apt on the old posters. It shares one of the defining characteristics of at least the first one film of that series, inasmuch that it's actually really quite enjoyable and brainlessly charming to watch. At the same time, it's not something that you're really going to want to watch an awful lot of times in a row, or possibly ever again. It's an adequate, big-budgety, action-y, spectacular, tentpole-y type thing, and if you're in the mood for that sort of thing, it would probably, I think, send you home happier than Iron Man 2 would.
Ooh.
It's resolutely sitting in rather than trying to change the cinematic landscape, but, well, there's room for that in the world. I thought this was perfectly decent film to watch. It's charming and adequate enough. It's I'm not going to lavish it with too much praise, but it's certainly passed the couple of hours very enjoyably. And yeah, easily the best video game adaptation, faint praise such as that is.
Yeah, that's certainly is faint praise, but it's nice that somebody's managed it at all.
Rather. Drew, you're going to tell us all about the losers.
The losers are US Special Forces team. They're sent on a mission in Bolivia to take out a drug dealer. And when they see some kids being bust in or brought into the drug dealer's house, they decide that they can't allow the kids to die. So they tell their superior that they're going to stop. He's not all that happy about it. Decides to try to kill them for their insubordination. And they survive, and the kids we're trying to save die. And then the rest of the film more or less revolves around them trying to get revenge on the guy that tried to get them killed. There's not a great deal of value more, spending any more time talking about the plot, because the plot, it's a pretty ordinary and predictable affair. Your double crosses, personal revelations and complications arising from involvement with women. And it's not meant to be a deep or clever film. It's a briskly paced action film that isn't meant to leave you any time to consider how daft the plot is. Unfortunately, though, it's simply not very enjoyable. The performance in the cast I found uniformly flat, and there seems to be little to no chemistry between them. Director Sylvan White, who's more familiar with music videos, seems to have invested far more in action and style than in drawing engaging or entertaining performances from his cast. The result of that is that rather than a close-knit group who take the mickey out of each other but maintain a strong team spirit and who have faith in each other's abilities, the losers feel like a loose collection of people that barely tolerate each other at best. The biggest problem of this lack of engagement with any of the characters is the villain, Max, a CIA super spy who seems to me at least, a capricious and intelligent eccentric who doesn't tolerate lesser intelligence in his subordinates and who possibly believes that his actions will benefit his country or who possibly is just crazy. However, though, Jason Patrick's Max is just a tiresome jerk. So, unfortunately, I didn't get an awful lot out of this film. Some of the stylistic touches are quite nice. It feels quite like a comic book, which is what this is based on. But I'm afraid it did very little for me. I didn't really care about the characters. none of the performances were in any way appealing to me, and it just bored me, I'm afraid. There's much more to say than that.
Dear, dear, Scott, did it bore you?
Not at all, actually. I have no real bones to pick with this film, although these days my definition of a good film is something that makes a couple of hours on the exercise bike pass more quickly. And I thought this did, but it's nothing more than a brainlessly enjoyable action film. And there's been many of them in the past, there will be many in the future. Whether there's any place in your heart for this is something you would have to decide. Definitely right in the sense that the plot is so generic that you could probably write it yourself. It's just enough to keep the action driving along. I thought I did that all right. I would have been incredibly annoyed by Max in almost any other film that didn't have a DC Vertigo logo at the start of it, but I can't really fault a comic book film for having a comic book villain in it. It doesn't make an awful lot of sense, but then it doesn't really need to, I suppose. It's fine, I guess. I like the stylistics. It's obviously aiming to try and be cool, and that's obviously a very dangerous thing because it's very easy to fall slightly short or go slightly too far and then wind up just looking stupid. And I thought, for the most part, this one did actually look pretty nice, and it's slick enough to sort of gloss over most of the flaws. I have no complaints about the cast either. I thought they were, you know, fairly likeable for the most part, obviously under stress and strain, which you'd probably expect them to start arguing a little bit given what's happened to them. There's definitely a lot more style than there is substance. Can't get away from that. But it's slickly enough handled that I didn't really have any major problems with it. Again, it's not something that you should really be rushing out and seeing. It's probably the least of the films that we'll be talking about here. But at the same time, it's not dreadful. I've certainly seen an awful lot worse films, but it's only a little bit above mediocre, but I wouldn't say it's a bad film.
It's not dreadful by any means. And as I said, I like the style, and some of the action set pieces are entertaining enough, and it's just bombing along. The problem I had simply was that I didn't think the director got any sort of good performance out of the cast at all, so I was just finding them kind of annoying. And the villain, if it's like comic book villain, that would be fine. I just kind of found him an annoying prat. I didn't find it like interesting or mad or anything, just a bit rubbish. That was my problem with it.
I haven't seen it, so I can't possibly comment. The last film we're going to look at tonight is the Robin of Hood. I'm sure most people will be familiar with the story, but no doubt this is a slightly different take on it. Scott, what's the dealio?
Russell Crowe, Russell Crowe, riding through the glen. Russell Crowe, Russell Crowe, what a prick. Everyone's favourite phone-slinging, touchy, whiny, Aussie arsehole Russell Crowe again teams up with Ridley Scott for a Swords and Sandals epic, although it's Nottingham and Middle-earth England here that we're talking about, so it might as well be umbrellas and bows are a better order of the day. It positions itself as being, quite ludicrously, as being the untold true story behind a legend, which didn't work out particularly well for King Arthur when it tried that trick a few years ago, and it doesn't really work out any better for this. It's a series of educated guesses more than anything else, and although it was pre-roll hype from Crowe himself banging on about how it's not what you're expecting, it takes a story and it twists it, it'll screw with your mind, man. It's essentially more or less the same as you've seen before. The only difference is that it spends an awful lot, well, in fact all its time, focusing on the makings of the Robin Hood character rather than Robin Hood himself. It's a kind of Robin Hood Begins kind of thing, if you'll pardon the expression. The only problem with it is that these sort of unique twists that it's talking about are pretty much cobblers, and it feels more like filler than anything else. It's going more into Robin Hood's character, his journey from a common self-serving soldier into a hero through discovering his forgotten past and his relationship with Marian and so on and so forth. But at heart, it is just still leading up to the inevitable conflict with King John and his status as an outlaw, although all of that stuff's kind of left on the table for presumably the inevitable Robin Hood 2, the revengeing. It leaves it with a kind of disjointed narrative of political intrigue that only feels barely connected to Robin, and as a character study it's just a little bit dull, to be honest. The sweeping action shots look sort of small scale and unimpressive when compared even to Gladiator, and there's no single element of the film that's actually bad or boring in and of itself, but it doesn't seem to add up to anything more than the sum of its parts. Crowe himself may be a good actor, and if you've got the ability to separate the work from the man, then you've probably got nothing to worry about from this film, and you'll probably enjoy it a lot more than I did. However, with every passing interview, he is crawling further up his own arse, and he's now just sort of sitting inside his own colon. If you can get a hold of the incredible self-entitled strop to BBC's front row presenter Mark Lawson, then try and watch it. It's quite remarkable. Lawson sort of dared to question what accent Crowe was going for, saying that he detected a hint of Irish in him. And Crowe took incredible offence at that, and it was really quite funny. I think he said that Lawson had dead ears, and I don't really know what that means. I suppose Lawson's wrong on at least one level. There's not really much Irish in Crowe's accent in Robin Hood. Martian, perhaps, or one of the outer moons of Saturn, but no Earth-based language. Otherwise, the acting's fine. There's plenty of stalwarts in here, from Cate Blanchett to William Hurt and Danny Houston, and they all put in pretty decent performances. Mark Strong's the nominal villain of the piece as Godfrey, and he's fairly effective. He's, you know, he seems like a, comes across as a strong villain, and that works quite well. King John's played by Oscar Isaac and does okay with a sort of whiny, snivelly, duplicitous sort of thing. But at the end of the day, I just really didn't care all that much about anything of it. It's not really doing anything massively new, and it's not cutting out much of an individual character for itself either, with Robin himself or anything that he does. Also, it does not have anyone threatening to cut someone's heart out with a spoon because it would hurt more, thus automatically making it a loser. Yeah, if you are in the mood for basically watching Gladiator again, but a bit less impressive, then knock yourself out and watch this. But it does feel awfully, awfully familiar. I felt an awful lot like I'd seen most of what this was trying to do before and done better in Gladiator. Gladiator's a far more interesting, and the themes that it deals with and the characters that it deals with are so similar that this almost feels like a English-based remake, and it's just not as impressive. There's nothing in the film that is technically bad in any way. I just really couldn't bring myself to care that much about any of it. It's fine. If you want to go and watch it, do so. It's not desperately unenjoyable. It's just sort of a bit dull and a bit kind of bloated and a bit turgid, and it's there and it's fine, but it's nothing more than that, and there's not really anything spectacular about it, which is a slight disappointment, and it's difficult to recommend spending the best part of a tenner going to see it on that basis.
I just find it increasingly difficult to recommend spending the best part of a tenner on anything that's got anything to do with Russell Crowe these days. Let's fight him.
Yeah. Let's throw phones at him.
Yeah, come on, Crowe.
Bring it.
What style is that you're using, Crowe? What's that fighting style? Self-taught! Robin Hood, take it or leave it. I'm going to leave it. And on that note, we will leave you, dear listeners. We'll be back in a couple of weeks' time, no doubt, with some more shizzle. But until thizzle, I'll say good bizzle. I've been...
Crizzle.
I've been in Crizzle, coming to you from near Lizzle, up in Gizzle was Skizzle.
Goodbye.
Good Bizzle, I think you mean. And in Fizzle was Dizzle.
See you on the flip side.
Cheerio.
I will not tolerate floating iguanas.